Lecture 9, Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia.
In the last two lectures, we've considered two of the ways Buddhism changed as it expanded out of its homeland, out of its original homeland in northern India. Disputes in the Buddhist community within the Sangha generated a series of sectarian movements that were known by the name Nikaya. The word Nikaya is not a particularly important technical word. It simply means school. And it's used to designate these sectarian movements that began to spin out in the Buddhist community after that event that's known as the Second Buddhist Council. We also saw in the last lecture that Buddhist artists and Buddhist craftsmen, whether all of these were artists in any recognizable sense is hard to know, but certainly craftsmen who were working in the Buddhist tradition developed different ways of representing the concept of the Buddha in visual form. First, of course, in the aniconic images that we discussed that are so problematic and difficult to interpret, and then, of course, in that full range of physical images that have been so important as a representation of the Buddhist tradition worldwide. We spoke about a few of the styles that were significant, the Mathura style, the Gandharan style, and the Gupta style, but there were more, and we'll have a chance in time to talk about those as we move through the later historical periods in the development of the Buddhist tradition. Now, many of these early sects, like these early Buddhist artifacts, are really historical objects at this point. We can study them in museums or we can read about them in texts, but we can't actually meet them on the street. They're not something that really is, as it were, an active representation of the Buddhist tradition today. One of these early sects, however, one of these early Nikayas is still active. This is the Theravada tradition in Southeast Asia. The word Theravada is the Pali form of the word Staviravada that I mentioned when we were talking about these sectarian movements. It means simply the doctrine of the elders. So it is, in its designation, a conservative tradition. It preserves the doctrine of this elderly, wise branch of the community, so it's oriented toward the preservation of Buddhist tradition. It expanded into Sri Lanka and then out into the rest of Southeast Asia, and it maintains for us today a pretty good vision, actually, of aspects of the Buddhist tradition as it would have been practiced in India in those early centuries after the death of the Buddha. Now, the history of the Theravada tradition in Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand and in other countries of Southeast Asia is obviously going to be too difficult too complex, really, for us to discuss fully in only a half-hour lecture. We have other places in this course we have to visit in the northern parts of Asia, and we've got other movements we have to consider, so we can't linger too long on this very appealing and very influential aspect of the Buddhist tradition. But I'd like to use this lecture to give you a taste of the history of the Theravada by looking at three representative figures who have shaped the development of the Theravada tradition as we know it today, and as we would encounter it if we went to visit the Buddhist communities in Sri Lanka or Thailand or Burma or one of the other places where the Theravada is practiced and active in Southeast Asia. The figures I have in mind are King Ashoka, the ancient king of the Mauryan dynasty who became the prototype of the righteous king or Dhammaraja, and whose son, according to Buddhist legend, became the first Buddhist missionary who carried the Buddhist tradition down into Southeast Asia. The second figure is King Mongkut of Thailand, who reigned from 1851 to 1868, and who, before he became king, spent 25 years in the monastery as a monk. And then, when he was instituted as king, began a reform movement to modernize the Thai Sangha. He's a king who had an enormous impact on Buddhist life in Thailand and crystallizes for us an important aspect of modern Theravada Buddhism. The third figure is a figure whom I particularly admire, one of the most intriguing modern figures in the Buddhist tradition, a woman by the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the leader of a democratic protest movement in Burma and was the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. And she, too, shows us the Buddhist tradition in a fascinating modern way, in a way that I think will intrigue you and challenge you to think of the Buddhist tradition in a new way. So let's start with King Ashoka, the prototype of the righteous king. When King Ashoka assumed the throne in the year 269 before the Common Era as emperor of the Maurya dynasty, he inherited a kingdom that had already been, what would be the right word, substantially expanded by his predecessors. It already dominated a large portion of India. But there was a particular kingdom that resisted domination by the Mauryas, kingdom of Kalinga. And Ashoka took it as his responsibility to bring the people of Kalinga into the empire. And he waged a very bloody and very cruel military campaign to bring the Kalinga people under his domination. The brutality of this campaign apparently provoked Ashoka to convert to Buddhism, to accept the Buddha Dharma, with its implicit ideal also of nonviolence, not merely respect and interdependence, respect for others and a sense of interdependence, but also policy of nonviolence. After his conversion, Ashoka proclaimed himself a righteous king, a Dhammaraja, or a protector of the Dharma. Now, actually, I should pause for a moment here about one funny little inconsistency in the way I'm speaking to you. We've been talking about the Buddha's teaching as being his Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A, common word. It's a word I suspect that you knew before you began to listen to this course. And then occasionally I lapse into Pali and call it the Dhamma. This is not because my tongue has become thick and I can't somehow wrap my tongue around the words. A lot of the traditions about Ashoka are passed on in Pali, particularly this concept of the Dhammaraja. So you'll find that I use sometimes the Pali word, the Pali version of the word Dharma, which is Dhamma, and sometimes the Sanskrit word. All of this confusion will end in our next lecture when we go back to Sanskrit and use Sanskrit for the rest of our discussion of the Indian tradition. Now, Ashoka, the Dhammaraja, advocated a policy of conquest by Dhamma or Dharma. It's called Dhamma Vijaya, conquest by Dharma. Ashoka's position was recorded, interestingly and importantly for us, really, on a series of rock edicts, that is, carvings on rocks that were placed at strategic parts around his empire, strategic locations around his empire. This is nice for us because we can still go there and read them. If they'd been written on palm leaves and distributed in marketplaces, the palm leaves would long since have moldered away. But we've actually got these Ashokan inscriptions that come to us from directly from the time of Ashoka. Rock Edict 13, by the conventional numbering, gives an account of his conversion. I'll read it to you. It's fascinating, actually, to hear in Ashoka's own words, in his imperial edict, about his conversion to Buddhism. 8 years after his coronation, King Devanampriya Priyadarshi, his way of designating himself, conquered the country of Kalinga. 150,000 people were deported, 100,000 were killed, and many times that number perished. Now that the Kalingans have been taken, Devanampriya is zealous in his study of Dharma. Devanam Priya, it's a word that means simply the beloved of the gods, feels sorrow at having conquered the Kalingans. Indeed, Devanam Priya wishes all beings to be safe, restrained, and even keeled in the face of violence. For Devanam Priya considers the foremost form of conquest to be Dharma conquest. This is this basic theme of conquest by the Dharma rather than by conquest by force of arms. Other rock edicts talk about his policy to promote the Dharma, and you'll see, actually, if you could dig into these edicts a little bit, you'd find it some fascinating reading, actually, that his view of Dharma is not terribly complicated. It has to do with rather simple Buddhist values that have to do with respect for others and concern for their welfare. King Devanampriya Priyadarshi, says, I have had banyan trees planted along the roads to provide shade for beasts and people. And I have had mango groves planted. It's almost like he's the first environmentally aware king in ancient India. And I have had wells dug and rest areas built every mile, and here and there I've had watering holes made for the enjoyment of beasts and humans. Of course, previous kings as well have sought to please the people with such facilities, but I'm doing this so that people may follow the path of Dharma. So he explicitly links his concern for the welfare of the people of his kingdom with his policy to promote the Buddhist Dharma. Now, as part of this policy, King Ashoka sent missionaries out to spread the Buddha's teaching in India and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and his actions have served as a model for righteous kings throughout the Buddhist world. What is a righteous king? It's pretty simple. We know already, really, what the elements of this policy would be. A righteous king protects and promulgates the Dharma. Important basic function. In return, this is interesting to reflect on, I think, the king is recognized, or as we sometimes say in the literature on this topic, legitimated by the religious authority of the monks. So the king supports the monastery. There's sort of a ritual way that the monks can designate this guy as somebody whom people should respect and trust. So there's an important two-way relationship. The king supports the monks in a sense support the king and make it possible for the king to develop a sense of trust and confidence and loyalty among his people. In some situations, the relationship takes a more combative aspect, and the king disciplines and reforms the Sangha to make sure that it adheres to proper discipline and doesn't interfere in the affairs of state. Ashoka himself set an example for that reformist function when he said in another of his edicts, any monk or nun who causes a schism in the Sangha will have to wear the white robes of a layperson and will no longer be able to dwell in a monastic residence. This order should be made known both to the community of monks and the community of nuns, and a copy of this edict is going to be distributed to everybody in the laity so that they'll have a chance to watch out too and make sure that these monks and nuns don't do the kind of thing that will lead to some kind of fragmentation of the Sangha. Now, we'll see this ideal of the righteous king reappearing, really, throughout the Buddhist world, not just in Southeast Asia, but also in China and Tibet and Japan. And it's an important component for us in the complex structure of Buddhist society. Now, the next figure that I want to mention to you is a 19th century king in Thailand by the name of King Mongkut, who reigned from 1851 to 1868. He is, in my view, one of the most striking examples of a righteous king in modern history. He was known in his capacity as king as King Rama IV, or as King Mongkut. He's remarkable, in my view, because he combines the role of monk and king. He served as a monk for over 25 years, before he ascended the throne. So he came to his position as king already as a person who was deeply infused by monastic practice, as a member of the monastery. This is not common in the Buddhist world. It's quite striking that King Mongkut brought that background with him to the throne in Thailand. As king, he believed that Thai monastic life needed to be reformed, purged of superstitious practices, and returned to the pristine model of the early canonical scriptures, the scriptures that we call the Pali Canon. See, he was, in addition to being a monk and a king, also a modernist. He wanted to reform the Sangha to bring it back to what he thought was the pristine ancient practice of the Buddha as it was reflected in the Pali Canon. We haven't talked much about this before, but this is an important aspect of contemporary Buddhism as you'll encounter it throughout Southeast Asia and, in fact, throughout the world. There is a modernizing impulse to strip away what people think of as being superstitious practices, things that have been added to the tradition over the course of its history, and return to the ancient practice of the Buddha. You see this also in other religious traditions as well. This is really the form, a form of Buddhist modernism. Now, he gave institutional expression to these ideas by creating a Thammayut movement. This is the name of his movement in the Thai Sangha, the Thammayut. During the reign of his son, King Chula Longkorn, who reigned from 1868 to 1910. As you can see, he bridged the gap between the 19th century and the 20th century. This reform movement was extended throughout the Thai Sangha and given the status of an official orthodoxy. So King Mongkut created a reform movement that eventually was extended to the whole Sangha and became, as you might say, sort of the modernizing matrix of Thai monastic life. It's one of the reasons why the Thai monastic system has been able to adapt as well as it has to the challenge of modernity. And it still provides the ideology, the conceptual framework for the relationship between the Thai royal family and Thai monastic life. Thailand continues to be an example, even today, of the close alliance between king and sangha in the extension and the protection of Buddhist values. This is something that you might well keep in mind if you ever have a chance to visit Bangkok. It's actually a great place to be a tourist, although the traffic these days is getting pretty formidable. It's pretty tough to weave your way through rush hour traffic in Bangkok, and rush hour lasts pretty much all day long. When you visit there, when you stop in Bangkok, one of the great standard stops on the tourist route is the royal shrine that's called the Temple of the Emerald Buddha. And you'll see very clearly in that place this intersection of royal values and Thai Buddhist values. It's really a shrine that honors the monarchy and also honors at the same time the central place of the Buddha within the structure of the Thai national identity. The center of the Temple of the Emerald Buddha is a very small but quite impressive little emerald statue of the Buddha that was discovered in somewhat remarkable circumstances back several centuries ago, back in the 15th century, I believe. And it serves not just as a focus of worship, but as a symbol of Thai national identity and a symbol of the legitimacy of the royal family. It's well worth reflecting on as a indication of the relationship between Thai Buddhist values and the values of the royal family. Now, the last figure that I want to discuss with you is Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma, a democratic activist and Nobel laureate. She's another striking example for us of the intersection between religious and political values in the Theravada countries of Southeast Asia. Aung San Suu Kyi was born in 1945. as the daughter of Burma's national hero, General Aung San. He was the leader of the Burmese liberation movement in World War II and was assassinated in 1947, just after the end of the Second World War and just as Burma was going to receive its independence from British and Japanese domination. Aung San Suu Kyi was educated in Rangoon, Delhi, and Oxford, and settled down to raise a family in Oxford. She married an Englishman by the name of Michael Arris, had two sons, and was living a rather comfortable and pleasant life as an academic person in England, quite far away, really, from all the concerns of Burma and Southeast Asia. Then her mother became ill. And she went back to visit her mother in 1988, really to offer her mother some comfort and some companionship in her illness. And just at that time, by accident, the military government in Burma had declared the possibility of an election. And as the daughter of this great hero of the Burmese National Liberation Movement, she was drawn naturally into the movement for democratic reform in Burma and became really the symbol of that party and of that movement within Burmese life. Despite being placed under house arrest, she was arrested very soon by the military government when her political appeal became manifest, her movement won a colossal election victory in May 1990. The military government annulled the results of the election and imprisoned its leaders. So Aung San Suu Kyi has been held under house arrest since 1990 in Rangoon, but she's continued to speak out in favor of democratic values and the democratic movement. In 1991, under the impetus of some previous recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, she was given the Nobel Peace Prize herself for what the Nobel Committee called her unflagging efforts for democracy, human rights, and ethnic conciliation by peaceful means. Aung San Suu Kyi's political philosophy seems on the face of it to be pretty simple, but there's force and eloquence in her words, as there was in the teaching of the Buddha, simple, strong, forceful words in favor of the democratic reform of Burmese society. One of her most famous speeches is called Simply Freedom from Fear. It's one that would be well worth looking up, actually. I think you can find it on the internet. It's well worth reading as an expression of her political philosophy. The speech begins by saying, "It's not power that corrupts, but fear. Fear of losing power corrupts those who wield it, and fear of the scourge of power corrupts those who are subject to it." Near the end of the speech, after she's explored this theme for a while, she refers to Mahatma Gandhi's statement that the greatest gift for an individual or a nation is fearlessness. Not merely, as Gandhi said, bodily courage, but the absence of fear from the mind. Now, when Gandhi talked about the gift of fearlessness, he was doing something that he was actually very skillful at. He was referring to an ancient practice of the Buddha. We talked, of course, last time about the tradition of Buddhist art, and you were aware, if you had a chance to see any of those images or if you've seen any Buddhist images in other places, that hand gestures are particularly important in Buddhist statues. We talked about the earth-touching gesture, where the Buddha reached down to the earth and the earth shook to bear witness to the strength of his meditation. We also have talked about the gesture in which you fold your hands in your lap, placing one hand on the other and placing your thumbs together in a posture of meditation. There also are other gestures, too. One is a hand extended right at waist level. That's the gesture of generosity, which the Buddha gives the Dharma to people. You probably, if you've been able to watch me in action here. You probably have seen me doing this instinctively because in a certain way, I suppose I'm giving you, or at least attempting to give you the gift of the Dharma as I speak, so you can hear in my words something like this gesture of the giving of the Dharma. Another important gesture that the Buddha made is the gesture of fearlessness, where he raised his hand up above his shoulder in what we sometimes call a traffic cop gesture. It actually comes from a story in the Buddha's life where he was in a conflict with an associate in the monastery who was attempting to split the Sangha and stage a revolt. Stage a protest against the Buddha. In order to do this, he wanted to intimidate the Buddha, so he set a raging elephant loose on a narrow street where the Buddha was walking. The raging elephant came charging down the street and was about to run over the Buddha. And the Buddha fearlessly, calmly, according to the story, raised his hand in the great traffic cop gesture, and the elephant stopped in his tracks and bowed down and paid his homage. That's traditionally described in Buddhist culture as the gift of fearlessness. It's an important aspect of the Buddhist tradition, and it's one of the most characteristic gestures of the Buddha. You might actually, I don't know if you like to use these things in your own experience, but as professors, we often have fearful students who come into our office. And oftentimes, they come into our office and we don't have the time to deal with all the issues that are being dumped out onto the desk in front of us. And sometimes it's helpful just to say, you know, Grace, Jim, Peter, whoever you are, Fred, I can't talk about everything you're putting out there for me today, but let me give you the gift of fearlessness. Take courage in your difficulties, because there will be a way for you to work your way through the challenges that seem to lie in front of you. And come back tomorrow in office hours and maybe we can talk about it in a little more detail. It's the kind of thing that Mahatma Gandhi, of course, spoke about quite passionately in his own campaigns for liberation from British control in India. And it's something that Aung San Suu Kyi picked up on in her own campaign for democratic values in Burma. But she gave it a little twist, a little Buddhist twist, like the twist that we've spoken of in some other aspects of the Buddha's teaching. She said, fearlessness may be a gift, as Mahatma Gandhi said, and as was represented in this gesture, this classic gesture of the Buddha, but perhaps more precious is the courage that is acquired through endeavor, through your own efforts. Courage that cultivates the habit of refusing to let fear dictate your actions. Now, as you listen to these words, you can hear how Aung San Suu Kyi's career brings together modern democratic values and the fundamental Buddhist values of courage, patience, tolerance, and nonviolence. It's a powerful mix, I think, for anyone who thinks that Buddhist values belong only in the monastery. Here they play a forceful and active role in political life, as they have in the Buddhist tradition all the way through its history, from the time of Ashoka to the present. Now, you might ask, why, of all the possible figures in Theravada Buddhist history, and of course there were many great monks and nuns and donors and activists of all sort, why, of all those possible figures, I've chosen to focus on these three political leaders, King Ashoka, King Mongkut, and Aung San Suu Kyi? There really are two reasons for this. One is to raise the issue for us of the relationship between Buddhism and politics. This is not something that you'd normally think of as being, as it were, consistent with traditional Buddhist values. If we have an image of the Buddha as monk, it's hard to imagine him as a politician. And yet the relationship between Buddhist values and politics has been a deeply rooted theme in Buddhist life. It's important for us to consider it in order to develop a full understanding of Buddhist society and to see how Buddhism wove its way into the life of other civilizations in Asia. My second reason for choosing these figures is to raise the question of modernity. It's very easy to imagine that the Buddhist tradition is only a historical artifact, something associated with the teaching of the Buddha, distant civilizations, distant from us not just geographically but historically. The truth is, of course, that Buddhism and Buddhist people have been involved in the process of modernization just the way religious people have been in cultures that are closer to home. So it's useful for us to see in King Mongkut and in Aung San Suu Kyi some of the subtle and very powerful ways that Buddhism has been brought into relationship with the challenges of modernity. We'll certainly see more about that as we discuss other important religious figures who have brought Buddhism into the contemporary world.